It's 7 minutes past 10 o'clock. I'm Cara Laurence, and I am welcoming one of the greatest stars of opera to the studio here today, who's rolling her eyes. Stephanie Blythe can be found on the world's stages and is one of the most beloved singers of today, I think, and the future as well. We'll go down as one of the great, great performers of our time.
My goodness.
Along for the ride is executive director of Fontana and longtime friend of Stephanie's, David Baldwin. Welcome to the studio to both of you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
David Baldwin, this is a Fontana presentation tonight at 7:30. Tell us the details for people who want to hear about it up front.
Yes, so the concert is this evening at 7:30, Dalton Center Recital Hall, and tickets can be had by visiting fontanamusic.org or visiting our office at the Epic Center or calling 382-7774.
The program is called Sing America.
Mm-hmm.
And Stephanie, why are you in Kalamazoo?
Well, who wouldn't want to be in Kalamazoo, first of all? Because I've always had a fascination with wonderful names of towns. I am in Kalamazoo with this program, Sing America, which is a recital that I developed a few years ago. It is what I call an exaltation. It's an exhortation to the citizens of this great country to start singing again. And so what this program is, it's a sing-along recital. So the audience actually sings about 75% of the recital. And everywhere I've done this program, it has been unbelievably fun. The audience has enjoyed themselves enormously. And it creates a beautiful community between the performer and the audience, which is what I think recitals is all about. And it also gets to introduce people to songs that they may not know. And also, it's an unbelievable evening of nostalgia for people who enjoy nostalgia, and I'm one of those people. I adore it. So it's a lot of fun.
What kind of songs do you choose from?
Well, I very much enjoy American Songbook from Tin Pan Alley in the 1930s and 1940s, and that's what a lot of this music is. And some of it is even earlier, early 1900s. The earliest song is 1905. And these are songs that are part of what I call the collective conscious of our culture. These songs have been used many, many times for many, many years in advertisements, in movies. And so we know the songs, but we may not know the songs. You know what I mean? You hear them and you go, oh, I know that tune.
Right.
It's the way people feel about Carmen. You may not know opera, but when you hear the Toreador song, you may not know it's the Toreador song, but you know it's Carmen, you know.
It's probably Tom and Jerry that you learned
exactly,
from right?
Exactly. Well, that's a perfect example, actually,
right,
David, because right. All of those early, all the Merry Melodies cartoons, all the Looney Tunes,
mm-hmm.
Warner owned all of this music.
Okay.
And so they used Carl Stalling, who was the major music arranger for Looney Tunes, used all of this music because it was free. And so the places where a lot of people heard this music were in Bugs Bunny cartoons. And they were used, I mean, in any one of those cartoons, you'll hear at least a half a dozen songs. And you'll hear snippets of songs all the time. California, Here I Come. Always, constantly used. Every time Bugs had someplace to go, California, Here I Come was the song that was played.
Right.
There's a terrific song that I really love that I'm just learning now called A Cup of Coffee, A Sandwich, and You. Right? And I thought, I know that tune. Where did I know that from? Witch Hazel sang it in a really great Halloween cartoon with Bugs Bunny. And they never sing the right words. She sang a cup of coffee, a cookie, and you, but it was very, very sweet. Anyway,
right.
So you get to know, that's how I learned a lot of these songs. Also, my connection with my grandfather, who was my paternal grandfather, who was very, very interested in singers of the day. And whenever we went to his house, this music was always playing, always. on the radio, mm-hmm. on the stereo, always playing. And that's where I heard a lot of this music. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I associate it very much with him. And also, I'm the child of a jazz musician. So I heard a lot of music like this early in my life. So it's very nostalgic for me.
You could make a case for calling it pop music, too. Popular song.
Oh, yes, you could. But I would call it, you know, when people think about pop music today, they think about dance, right? Because that's really what popular music is for today. It's for dancing. So it's really rhythm-based. It's not lyric-based.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Right? So it's used for a different reason. Popular music during this time period, 1900s, early 1900s, up until the 1950s, really, this music was used as entertainment at home. It's parlor music. So every home had a piano, and everyone had somebody at home who played. And so all of this music was, it wasn't passed around. It was played on the radio. It wasn't passed around on records all the time. It was passed around by people playing the songs and singing them. So they're written for a different reason. It wasn't dance music. It was parlor music to be sung at home to entertain yourself and your family. So actually, a lot of these songs were introduced by at Tin Pan Alley in New York City by guys who would, you know, they'd push a piano out onto the street with the Lotus sheet music they wanted to sell.
Yeah.
And they'd flog it out on the street. They would play these songs and sing them. And whoever sang them louder, you know, got more.
Sure.
And they called it Tin Pan Alley because they would put tacks on the hammers so that when they played
it, inside the instrument.
Yes. So when they played the piano, it was louder and it was very tinny and sounded like a load of pants, you know, it sounded like a load of pants banging right. together. It was very, no, it was because of that tinny sound that the pianos made. Right. Anyway, so they could get the sound out farther and they could get their songs out farther.
George Gershwin was one of those pianists.
You better believe it. Yeah. A lot of these guys, a lot of the people whose music I'm singing now did that. Yeah.
Well, David, would you tell me about your first impression of Stephanie? You've told the story at least once before on WMUK, but now she can hear it in person.
Right.
Oh my goodness.
So we were both students at Tanglewood in 1993.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the piano department studying with Margot Garrett, and Stephanie was obviously in the vocal department studying with Phyllis Curtin. And I just randomly went to a recital this one day, and she was singing this set of Du Parc songs. And my jaw just like fell to the ground, and it was just kind of a transformative thing for me because I was like, all right, now I know what they mean about colors in music. So anytime she sang that summer, I always went. And so the next time I think she did, I remember her sitting in the middle of a stage with a boa wrapped around her neck, singing a Sondheim. I Never Do Anything Twice? Does that sound right?
I was part of a cabaret evening where I sang in a weekend in the country.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then I sang I Hate Men.
That's what I'm thinking of is I Hate Men, yes. And so she had a boa. I just remember the boa.
Lord,
and
I
yeah.
no idea.
So then for the last concert of the summer that the studio was doing, I just gathered every single friend I had I had made over that summer and said, you need to hear this woman. And so they all came and, you know, of course, everyone was amazed. And then, you know, the summer was gone and we all left. And about 3 or 4 years later, I was working in New York for a management firm called ICM. Mm-hmm. And one day I walked into my office and there she was sitting on the couch in, you know, in our lobby. And I thought, oh, my God. And so I went into the head of the vocal division. And I said, you've got to have this woman, you know. And she already, that was already a done deal, I'm sure. But anyway, yeah, our paths have crossed several times.
If only you knew that Du Parc set that you heard me sing.
Oh, just gorgeous.
It was the first time I'd ever sung Du Parc. And I remember I was singing with a pianist named Joseph Lawson.
Right.
And I was so proud of that concert. I was so proud of it. And those songs are huge. And I was really new. I mean, Tanglewood was a big deal
for me. We were in our
early
20s. Yeah,
yeah. I was 23.
Yeah, I was 22. Yep.
And I was on the cusp of everything starting for me. And I was just out of, what was I doing that year? I was studying with a new teacher and, you know, basically living with her and getting myself ready for a bunch of auditions. Because the next year I would audition for the Met and become a member of the Young Artist Program.
Right.
And that all happened between when you heard me and the next Tanglewood season.
Sure.
Everything changed. By the next summer, I was already accepted into the Young Artist Program at the Met, and you know, it was crazy. But this was a very exciting time for me anyway. I remember getting the recording of those DuParc songs after the concert, and I listened to them shortly before I was supposed to do a Kilpinen song in a masterclass with Ken Griffiths, mm-hmm. who was one of the coaches there. And I listened to the recording of my concert. And I was devastated because it was awful. I mean, it was all the things that I thought I was doing, I wasn't doing. I was such a baby. And I, you know, what I heard in my head was not what had come.
Are you sure?
Well, that's not what I heard.
Well, no. We all hear ourselves with a completely different
ear.
And I remember my very, very dear friend and mentor, Alan Lewis Smith, who has become one of the biggest fixtures in my musical and personal life, who's written unbelievable song cycles for me. And it was our first summer working together, and he saw me sitting in the back of the room crying. I was just a mess. And he took me into a stairwell. And he said, Stephanie, you have to understand, you don't drive around a little Dodge Dart voice. You have a big old Lincoln Continental with all the bells and whistles. And he says, you just don't know your user manual yet.
Right.
And once you understand your manual, once you understand how to drive that car, you're going to be able to drive it anywhere you want. You're learning now. So just take it one day at a time. Was the best advice. That is advice that anybody, no matter what they do, can use, because that's really it.
True.
And that little piece of advice, I believe that that's true about life. That I believe that we are born knowing everything. And the minute that we hit the air, everything goes.
We lose it all.
We lose it all. And we spend our whole lives writing that manual. Whole lives. We figure out how we work and our own technique. Because there's a technique to everything, including just being yourself.
Mm.
And everyone has an individual one. So it was a very, very cathartic, that concert was so cathartic for me.
Well, me too.
So thank
just
you
in different ways.
So thank you for reminding me of it so beautifully.
Right.
Have you ever talked to an engineer who has passed on what it's like for him to try to record your voice?
Yes.
What do they say?
It's not easy. Well, the thing is, it's not easy to record an operatic voice because the nature of the instrument is not close up. We work to be heard far away. So we project our voices. And what you get close up is just not the real, it's not the real deal. I find that if I do anything that's really close up mic'd, you get a lot of tenor, a lot of treble, and very little bass. And it just is not the color's not right, which is why I record with Meyer Sound in Berkeley, who record me using their Constellation system. It's a very, very complicated thing, but they record me in a room where they have put a sound system that changes the acoustic of the room. So they record the room instead of just the instrument. So there's no close-up miking on me, no close-up miking on the piano, and we mix it as we go. As we're singing, we do the editing.
I imagine there's really difficult computations where they are also calculating for distance and reflections and
it's all They just use a few stereo mics about 16 feet away.
Ah.
It is remarkable. And so that has been sort of a revelation to me. And also the work that I've been doing with them most recently, all of the songs that we record are one take. There's no editing at all. So if we screw up, we just stop and we start again.
Oh, well.
And that's the way things, all of the songs I sing now, those songs, when they were originally recorded, that's how they were recorded.
Right.
One go.
Right.
No editing.
Right. I was going to say 1920s, no editing. 1930s
that's
style.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's... Right. In no editing, no cutting and pasting, and no auto-tune.
Well, let's get back to the concert after we hear a number that you brought along. David, would you introduce this first song?
Yes, this is a song called Always, and Stephanie recorded an album called As Long As There Are Songs, and this is one of the pieces mm-hmm. on that album.
That's Stephanie Blythe singing Always. Mm. Stephanie Blythe here in the studio along with David Baldwin of Fontana. She'll present her program Sing America at 7:30 tonight in the Dalton Center Recital Hall. And she'll be joined by a pianist named Mario Antonio Mara
mm-hmm.
and joined by you. In the audience.
That's right.
As you sing along. during the music, you mentioned Irving Berlin as a mm-hmm. particular favorite of yours.
Well, he was a genius, wasn't he? Honestly.
Yes.
The guy wrote so many beautiful songs. I mean, just hit after hit. And this particular song, I'll tell you a story about it. This song was originally written for his music secretary. I don't know if you know or not, but Irving Berlin could not write music. He could not read and write music. And he only played in one key. He played only the black keys on the piano.
The black keys. Wouldn't it be easier to play this?
No. He played in one key and he had what was called a transposing piano. So all he had to do was move a lever and it would turn into the key that he wanted to, but he continued to play the same keys. And he had a music secretary who would write out music for him. And she had complained to him one day that he'd never written a song for her. So he wrote her a song, and it was called I'll Be Loving You, Mona. That's Always. Anyway, that song got shelved. And Irving Berlin was married twice. His second wife was a woman named Ellen McKay, who was the daughter of a very, very wealthy man in New York City. She was a debutante, you know, she was they were very, very, very wealthy family. And her father threatened to disown her if she married Irving Berlin. Number one, because he was a Jew. And number two, because he was a musician. And she said, okay, disown me. Disinherit me. And she married him. So as a wedding gift, he gave her Always. And gave her the rights and all of the royalties that ever came from it went to his wife, Ellen McKay. And that was his wedding present to her. And it is his most successful song. And there has never been a concert where I've performed this song. And I sing this song on every concert that I do. If not in the body of it, as an encore. And I've never, ever, ever done it and not looked out in the audience and seen at least a half a dozen couples look at each other and smile, or somebody starts to cry, or hands start getting held. It is the most wonderful, perfect song. Hmm. Absolutely perfect.
These were tough, tough times. The sure. world was going through two world wars during this era of songwriting. Mm-hmm. And yet the purity of the sentiment is never backed down from. There's no sense of, this is a gray, complicated world. This is more of a pure trust. And
there are a lot of silver lining songs, you know, including Look for the Silver Lining.
Sure. There's that.
Terrific. It's a fantastic. But they're songs, you know, they performed a very, very specific function at this time. And they were used to, I've used this phrase many times, especially in conjunction with my cabaret show about Kate Smith. They were used to galvanize the nation, to comfort. And people saw music performed this. There was just something about the connectivity of radio. So I often say in my cabaret show that it was really the first kind of social network, because people were gathered together because they were hearing the same things at the same time. You know, they were tuning into the radio at the same time and hearing this music. It created a community and a sense that none of the songs say, none of those Silver Linings songs say everything's okay. They all say there will be a time where things will be all right again. And they're hopeful. They're very, very hopeful. And also they speak to everyone. And I love that. It's universal. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter who you are. Doesn't matter what your religion, what you know, where you live in the world. It doesn't matter. Your sex, your sexuality, whatever it is, doesn't matter. This music speaks to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little about the accompanist you are bringing on, working with Mario Mara.
Mario Antonio Mara is a brilliant young pianist who is in, he's currently a part of the Ryan Center, which is the young artist program for Chicago Lyric Opera. I met Mario when he was a student of my collaborative partner, Warren Jones, at Manhattan School of Music. And he was playing for a masterclass. And when this guy put his hands on the piano, I was blown away. And I loved the personality there. There's just he's full of love and energy and enthusiasm, married to a brilliant technique and a phenomenal mind. And I knew immediately that I wanted him for a Fall Island Vocal Arts Seminar, which is a summer program that I have for American contemporary art song. And he was one of our pianists last summer, and it was just fantastic. And of course, I know him from Chicago Lyric. His star is just about to rise. What people here in Kalamazoo are going to be very fortunate to hear, someone who is going to become a major star. And this is our first time performing together, and I can't wait. I can't wait, and I'm very honored to introduce him like this. He really enjoys this music very, very much, and he has a wonderful penchant for it. And so I'm truly excited. He also works with Craig Terry, who is another one of my collaborative partners, and Craig Terry runs the Young Artist Program at the Ryan Center at Chicago Lyric. So this was, it's sort of a big family affair, actually.
Well, let's remind people that the concert is tonight at 7:30. Tickets are available at fontanamusic.org or by calling 382-7774. Let's get back to your recording, mm-hmm. As Long as There Are Songs. And it looks like we'll continue with a famous, famous song, How Deep is the Ocean?
This one is particularly, we were just discussing this on the way here, haunting to me. It's just one of the most beautiful arrangements I've ever heard of, mm-hmm. this song. And it's just, it's very arresting.
That's Stephanie Blythe with How Deep is the Ocean. If you just tuned in, my guest is Stephanie Blythe, the world-renowned mezzo-soprano who can be found on opera stages around the world, and David Baldwin, executive director of Fontana. And Fontana presents a solo recital by Stephanie Blythe called Sing America tonight. And you're focusing on the Great American Songbook.
Sure.
Songs written in the 10s, 20s, 30s.
Yes, and let's keep saying that it's a sing-along concert. So Sing America is it's a request. It's it's a request.
Yeah. How are you going to get people to sing with you?
Oh, honey, it takes nothing.
Reticent Midwesterners.
It takes nothing. You just wait. You coming to the concert?
Yes.
Just wait. People can't wait to sing. And I started doing this because when I wrote this cabaret about Kate Smith. And performed it with my dear friend Craig Terry, who was playing the piano on the song you just played. And twice in that program, I do a sing along. One is with the song "We'll Meet Again," and the other is "God Bless America." And I noticed all night long, the first time I ever did that show, mouths going all night long. They were desperate to sing. And when I invited them to sing this repeat of "We'll Meet Again," it took nothing. They were so excited. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to try doing this sing-along a little bit more. So in my encores, I would invite people to sing. And it always happened. No problem. So I thought, well, why don't we do a whole program like this and really get people singing? Because communal singing is not done anymore, except in church, in worship service. You know, there's communal singing, you know, Christmas carols, communal singing. And this music is, it cries out just to have fun and sing. And I sing at home with my husband all the time. So it's great fun.
I can promise you there will be some songs I don't know.
Oh, you will have no problem. And you'll have the music.
Exactly.
You'll have the music. So here's how it works. I sing a verse. And then I sing a chorus, and then I invite the audience to sing the chorus with me.
Yeah.
Then I sing the second verse, and the audience sings the chorus. And if we really enjoy it, we'll sing the chorus again. And the audience has all of the music, has all the words. It doesn't matter if you can read music or not, because you'll have the words, and you will have heard me sing it. So you won't have any. I promise you won't have any problems.
So it doesn't have to be in your living memory to.
Absolutely not.
No. I have a feeling that a lot of it, like we were saying earlier, will come back to you and be like, "Oh God, I know that tune."
That,
you know, so I don't necessarily know the words, but here are the words right in front of me. So yeah.
So I promise I would tell you a story about How Deep is the Ocean. Do you want to hear it?
Please. Yes.
Okay. So when I was first of all, the song, also by Irving Berlin, was very, very important to him. Because he lost everything in the stock market crash. And during the same time period, his infant son, Irving Berlin Jr., died. And it was a horrible time for him. He also, he thought he'd lost his creativity. He couldn't write songs. This went on for quite a long time. And he just thought everything he wrote was terrible. And he would invite people off the street to come in and listen to songs. Anybody, you know, his doorman, please come and listen to this. Do you think this is any good at all? And there were two songs that brought him back. Say It Isn't So and How Deep Is the Ocean. Two of his most poignant, deep songs. And that's why I really love this song, because it's a perfect little jewel. It's like, What'll I Do? You know, it's one of those songs. And when I first sang this, I had recently acquired a Boston Terrier puppy named Dainty June. I named my dog's musical theater names. Her predecessor was Agnes Gooch, who was a glorious black pug that I adored and had for 12 and a half phenomenal years. And so Dainty June was very, very small at this point and very, very noisy. And I was rehearsing with Craig at my home, and she wanted to be with me all the time. And so I held her in my arms and sang How Deep Is the Ocean to her. And as I sang it to her, she fell asleep in my arms. Mm-hmm. And so now whenever I sing How Deep Is the Ocean, I think about Dainty June passing out in my arms, and it's my song to June.
Nice.
And that's how I feel about her too.
Right.
But I have a particular love of that song.
You're not afraid to just be sentimental about any.
Why? Right. Life's too short. If you feel love towards something, do it.
Right.
You know.
But you're involved in another art form, opera,
mm-hmm.
that most people associate with kind of this elite club who...
Oh, no.
who only understand... It's all languages you can't understand and stories that seem unbelievable. And I'm just speaking from a devil's advocate point of view
course,
here, but...
I understand.
Here you are embracing what looks like simpler, easy songs as well.
You know, music is important because it's what connects us as human beings. Art is important because it's what connects us as human beings. When we don't connect as human beings, things go awry. Mm. And that's why the arts are so unbelievably important. In my operatic world, I feel the exact same way about the music. I do. I feel an enormous amount of love and nostalgia. I feel an enormous amount of respect and adoration for the characters that I play. It doesn't matter if I'm playing the Queen of the Gods in The Ring Cycle, or if I'm playing Azucena in Trovatore, who's, you know, hellbent on revenge. It doesn't matter. Whatever character it is, these are characters that I love, and it's my duty as an artist to present these characters or present these songs to an audience and do it in a way that the audience can recognize something of themselves in that. And that's when I think opera really works. Opera works when the audience finds themselves reflected in that art form. Why are you attracted to a painting? It's the same thing. If you go to a great painting and you really love it, one of my favorite paintings is by Edward Hopper. It's called 7 o'clock Sunday Morning. I look at that painting and it makes me, as we would say where I grew up, it makes me kvel inside. It's a very good Yiddish word for, you know, it's overwhelming. And there's something about that painting that connects me as a human being to that work. It's the same thing with opera. Opera is only distant when people make it that way. It doesn't have to be. And when it's really, really something, it's when it sparks something inside of you as an audience member. And what I love about this music is that I spend an enormous amount of time when I'm performing, especially in recital, whether I'm doing, you know, singing Brahms or singing Barber songs or whatever it is that I'm singing, or American Songbook, Tin Pan Alley. I look my audience in the eye. I connect with them. And they feed me as an artist. And I try to give them the ability to access memories and experiences that they've had in their lives. So that when they hear something, they go, oh, you know, I know what that's like. And I've experienced that, and I felt that way. And when they do that, they want to continue feeling that way. So they go to more concerts. That's how I really believe we grab audiences. When opera is really, really good. And this is the experience I had as a child and as a teenager going to the opera. I see myself in those characters. And I become invested in them. And it doesn't matter that they're singing in French or they're singing in German or Italian. Doesn't matter. Because I want the best for those characters. Mm-hmm. I want to see things turn out great for them. And when they don't, I'm heartbroken for them. And when they're victorious, I'm victorious too. Right. So, you know, it's when we go to movies or we go to the theater, we go to ballet, it's all the same thing. Art is meant to connect to the audience and then to feed out to the rest of the world and bring us all together. You know,
I think everyone can think of a picture that means something to
absolutely
them, that reflects something about how they are inside.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. And
if you are listening to this radio broadcast and you haven't found that piece of art that's done that for you, go out and find it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go out and find it. Because the more you do that, the more we feed our souls with art, the better we are, the more we know ourselves. You know? Mm-hmm.
You know, the Fontana season is a microcosm of this in a way. You began the season with a jazz program.
Yes.
And a solo recital of pianist Bertrand Chamaillou, and now a sing-along with Stephanie Blythe. That is part of your philosophy.
Yeah, I think we want to be able to access the whole full array of the palette of what goes on. And, you know, I think the only thing that we require is that it's quality. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't matter if it's jazz, it doesn't matter if it's solo piano, it doesn't matter if it's vocal. I have a choral piece, you know, or a choral group coming in, certainly plenty of chamber music. But it's just the important thing that it is to me is that it's quality.
Another song, perhaps?
Mm-hmm. Gordon Jenkins. Gordon, the great Gordon Jenkins, 1963, this song.
Oh, that's a bit
it's
later.
It's the latest time. Song that I sang of this ilk, but it's brilliant.
We're with Stephanie Blythe and David Baldwin of Fontana. Stephanie Blythe performs tonight with Mario Antonio Mara at 7:30 in the Dalton Center Recital Hall. The program is called Sing America. Mm-hmm. We just heard a gem of a song.
Yep.
This Is All I Ask. You were saying that the composer,
Gordon
Jenkins was Sinatra's
He was
arranger.
One of Sinatra's favorite arrangers, especially late on. In fact, Sinatra was one of the last singers to use Gordon Jenkins because he was very old-fashioned. He used a lot of orchestral string writing and big, big flourished writing. Gorgeous. And this song is just, it's breathtaking. And it has a verse that is gender-specific. And so when he presented the song to Sinatra, the line was, instead of one of the lines in the verse went, "Beautiful, beautiful girls, walk a little slower when you walk by me." Beautiful line. But the ladies' line is, "Soft-spoken men, speak a little softer when you speak to me." And I think that line is so unbelievably sexy. It is a phenomenal line. And I adore this song because it was introduced to me by my brother-in-law, who presented it to me in a record form from a recording, a very famous recording of Kate Smith at Carnegie Hall in 1965, I believe, with the great Skitch Henderson.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, with that band. Right. And she sang, it was the first time she ever sang that song, was at that concert in Carnegie Hall. And I just love her rendition of it. It's so beautiful. And I mean, this just song speaks to everyone. It's one of my favorite songs of all time.
You know, Stephanie, on Tuesday, I recorded a phone interview with another internationally acclaimed artist named Marc-André Hamelin, who's coming to town next week, who is equally as just interested, fascinated by the era and all of its composers. Mm-hmm. Like, we wouldn't know about Gordon. Gordon Jenkins might be consigned to obscurity without artists, you know, continuing to bring it to stage and bring it back to life. And Hamelin does much the same thing with, you know, who was writing alongside Brahms or who was...
Absolutely.
Right. You could recreate the era and the world.
Oh, yeah.
And you sound so fascinated.
Well, I am fascinated by it because, to be perfectly honest, when I do these recitals, when I put these concerts together, because I have several different Sing America programs. I curated one this summer with the Tanglewood. I teach at Tanglewood now in the summers. Right. And I did one with the students this summer called Sing America Songs of Travel. And it was all songs that were about going to places you were going to, and modes of transportation to get there. So we had Come Josephine and My Flying Machine and My Merry Oldsmobile. One of the songs we're going to do tonight called He'd Have to Get Under, Get Out and Get Under to Fix Up His Automobile, which is a brilliant song by Maurice Abrams. Very, very long title, but and not a lot of people will know this song, but I will teach it to them. And then places to go, like I Want to Go Back to Michigan, which is one of our songs tonight.
We're going to love that.
Oh, yes, you are. I love singing songs like that. And it's... when I do research for these, the problem I have is culling songs from the list because there are so many. Mm. And these writers were unbelievably prolific. They're not all gems. The ones I choose are all gems. But there is so much music that was performed. And the thing is,
it's not fair. We hear the same 12 over and over.
Right. And the thing is that I firmly believe when I teach, I ask students to sing this kind of music. And I'm doing this more because I feel like we need to own it. It is not this is not fluff. This is the music that inspired composers all through the century. So you talk to any of the composers, any of the art song composers. Now I'm talking about art song composers today. Any of the great art song composers today. They know all this music. It absolutely affected them and inspired them. So if it inspired the composers of today, why should it not inspire us? This is the birth of art song, of American contemporary art song. It's part of our literature, and it's dismissed as fluff. And it's not fluff, fluffy entertainment. Did you listen to the lyrics of any of these songs? Some of it is really great poetry.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, yes, there was fluff and hoochie coochie and ha cha cha. Yes, yes, there was that too. And that has its place. But this music, you know, it touches everyone. Mm-hmm. Because everybody has experienced love. Everybody has experienced loss. Everyone has experienced elation and depression. And, you know, as all of these composers and lyricists did. So we connect with the music very, very organically. Mm-hmm.
Stephanie and David, thank you for sharing your thoughts on the program with us here on WMUK. We've talked ourselves right up to the news. So let's hear a tiny bit of Irving Berlin to go out. Thank you again.
Okay.
Till the blue skies chase the dark clouds.